Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
With the G20 World Leaders Summit in Australia in 2014, our next guest is encouraging us to look at more than the mere economic performances of the world's largest economies. Dr. Brian Grimm is president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation and a leading expert on the socio-economic impact of restrictions on religious freedom. Dr. Grimm is in Australia for the G20 and starts with the key impacts of religious freedom, or indeed the lack of it.
Well, the responsibilities are twofold. One is that indeed there are situations where faith is used by people to gather people around a cause and you know, engage in conflict, and some of it very dastardly. So, for instance, what's going on in Iraq and Syria right now at the hands of ISIS is motivated by their interpretation of faith. But on the other side, what we find is that when religious freedom is respected by governments and especially by groups in society, including faith groups, then that promotes peace and prosperity. So it's not that religion causes conflict any more than other issues such as arguments over land or economics or rights or perspectives, but what we do find very significantly is that when religious freedom is respected, that promotes peace.
When did you first start to explore the links between freedom and social and economic successes in a country?
Well, there's two times in my own personal life that this really jumped out at me. The first was at the collapse of the Soviet Union. At that time, I was working in Almaty, which was then the capital of the Kazakh Soviet Socialist Republic. And one day, Boris Yeltsin, the leader of Russia, Nazarbayev, who was the communist leader of Kazakhstan and now the president of Kazakhstan, gathered and they dissolved the Soviet Union. And one of the first actions of now President Nazarbayev was to set up a business school, and he called on NGOs motivated by faith to help him set up that business school. And he gave over the Communist Party training school to turn it into the first Western business school. So, you know, he explicitly saw the value people of faith had in bringing a values-based market economy to what was, you know, very much a closed economic system. So that's sort of on a national level. But on a very personal level, I worked in two countries divided just by a line in the sand. Saudi Arabia was one, and the other was the United Arab Emirates. In Saudi Arabia, my faith, I'm a Catholic, was illegal, and it's still illegal to this day. You can't practice Christianity at all in the country of any form. But in the United Arab Emirates, where my faith was not only legal but encouraged, and Sheikh Zayed, who was alive at the time when I was working there, gave land and property and encouragement to faith communities. Well, I found in Saudi Arabia I had no motivation to work hard. I just, you know, felt like someone who was unappreciated. My faith was unappreciated, and I couldn't wait to leave. But in the United Arab Emirates, where my faith was acknowledged as a person of faith, you know, that encouraged me to contribute to the economy and work hard in the country. And you can see that in the innovation and in the diverse business in both countries. In Saudi Arabia, it remains an oil-driven economy, whereas the United Arab Emirates is a place where there's a lot of innovation and different business sectors growing. So I think you can see this connection between religious freedom and the role of faith and people of faith who bring their whole selves into a job rather than having to leave it at the border or outside the door of the company makes a big difference.
So if we add GDP or productivity to a country to the morality of religious freedom in a community, what then are some of the other benefits to religious freedom?
Well, I'll give an example from Brazil. It's a country I work in quite frequently, and it has some similarities to Australia as well. But Brazil has undergone the largest religious change of any country since 1980. They were nearly, 10 out of 10 people were Catholic at that time. Today, only two-thirds of the people are Catholic, and most have converted to other faiths. So they've become Pentecostals, evangelicals, Mormon Seventh-day Adventist, and then there's growing Muslim Jewish communities, and a small still percentage of unaffiliated. But all of that change happened at a time when they were coming out of dictatorship. And if religion had become an issue of conflict, the economic miracle and growth of Brazil would not have happened, because it was really that cohesion of society, not counting religious change and differences as a detriment, that made them be able to progress economically. So, you know, when you have these kind of situations of respect for other people's faith, it then encourages respect for women, respect for other human rights. And so religious freedom itself is, simply put, a matter of treating people of faith without discrimination. And that same principle applies to women, to minorities, to age, to many other sectors. So I see this spilling over. And one last note on Brazil that's very important in the modern world is this change happened with the majority faith, Catholicism, not trying to coercively prevent it happening, because it embraced the concept of religious freedom after Vatican II. And that's really where religious freedom either happens or doesn't, is whether or not religious groups themselves are open to people making the free choice to have a faith, change your faith, or have no faith at all.
Brian, when we consider the suppression of the religious voice, we often go to the archetypal governments, the bamboo and iron curtain, some parts of Asia. But in your research, you found some surprising quarters, for instance, the UK.
Yes, so, you know, when people think of, you know, extreme violations of religious freedom, you know, they rightly think of what's going on in Iraq and Syria today. But we find restrictions on religious freedom happening, you know, throughout the world. There's no country without restrictions. So there was a case where a woman in the United Kingdom wanted to wear just a very small cross as part of her uniform at British Air. And, you know, other employees, for instance, the Muslim women working beside her wore a scarf, and that was permitted. But she was fired for wearing a cross because they said it violated their uniform. Well, that later on, British Air has changed their policy, but, you know, she was fired and went without work. And that case went all the way to the European Court of Human Rights, and the court found that British law doesn't protect an employee's right to display a symbol of their faith at work, you know, a reasonable accommodation. So, you know, even in Western countries, we see these restrictions in place, and there's even calls to increase them, such as the ban on burqas that's been passed in France and for public areas in Belgium. So there's you know, a lot of restrictions growing, and much of it is because of people's fear of either new faiths coming in or fear of radical faith. You know, in my experience, much of the fear is unjustified.
The counterpoint, perhaps, to our discussion so far is Indonesia, our near neighbours, who require you to have a faith.
Yeah, that's something on the opposite end of the spectrum, which occurs in a lot of countries, especially Muslim-majority countries. So in Indonesia, atheism is outlawed by the government. So if you are an atheist, you're breaking the law. And there was a case, a young man, Alexander An, just posted on Facebook that he's an atheist. He, you know, left his faith, and mobs came, attacked him, and then when the police intervened, they didn't arrest the mobs. They arrested him for being a lawbreaker. He was, you know, declaring to be an atheist. So they, you know, the you know, part of that was to guard against what Indonesians fear was a communist takeover. But then these, you know, restrictions make it so that then religion itself becomes a highly regulated topic and a source of tension. So the beating that he received was in response to laws. And that's what we often see when the governments have discriminatory laws or, you know, repressive laws, that sets loose social hostilities.
Brian, as people of faith, we often view the rights of religious freedom through our own faith. Of course, the conflict comes when we deliver the message that religious freedom is vital, that we open the doors to religions that aren't our own.
Well, I can share some experiences speaking in the American context. So in the United States, there's, you know, the narrative that many people grew up with was that, you know, our country was founded as people fled religious persecution in Europe, and that it was founded on, you know, principles of, you know, Christian faith, and you know, that our nation is under God, and that people are created in the image of God. So, you know, these are, you know, some historical, you know, points that have helped define the country. But, you know, in the years since, and even at that time, you know, many people were unchurched and, you know, weren't practicing faith. But in the years since, the country's grown more diverse. We have sizable populations of people that, you know, don't identify with any faith. We have growing populations of Muslims. The second, or, you know, one of the largest Jewish populations in the world, you know, tied with Israel. And then within Christianity, there's so much diversity, Catholics and Protestants and, you know, hundreds of denominations of Protestants, and then a large growing Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. And so, you know, it's a very diverse mixture, not unlike Australia, you know, where you have quite a diverse mix as
Indeed.
Well.
Yeah.
And so what I found is that as people realize that you can't, you know, define the country as a Protestant, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant country. That's not, you know, that's not the reality of the United States. That then everybody's a minority in some way, and then people realize that for them to have a voice, then religious freedom becomes important. And maybe, you know, if you're, you know, if you're a Baptist, you may not appreciate a Catholic's point of view, but together you're concerned that both of you have the chance to practice the faith and share. And the same with even secular people. You know, they're concerned that that religion doesn't get forced upon them. But there's many, and we find 68% of people who don't have a particular faith in the United States still believe in God. So, you know, so there's movement in and out of faith. So there's a recognition that this freedom is very important in a pluralistic society. And, you know, sort of switching to another example, that my research shows that it's the attempt to enforce a single religious orthodoxy on an entire population that is really the trigger for violence. And so, you know, that's where we see the violence coming about. And so when people don't allow for, you know, the freedom of interpretation, freedom of change of faith, that's when religion really becomes a potential source of violence.
Brian, in your work with the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation, you're encouraging us not only to open our hearts and minds to the stories of repression around the world, but to actually advocate for those people on their behalf. How do you propose we do that?
Well, I think there's positive messaging is really important, because to always point out problems is, you know, something that you're willing to listen to on the news, but then quickly want to switch the channel and watch a comedy or, you know, watch something that's more edifying. So I think that religious freedom needs to, and the advocacy of religious freedom needs to break out of this just name and shame approach and celebrate victories of religious freedom. And so, you know, the example I gave of Brazil, you know, that you know, may be new to many people, that, you know, of that history. And there's many other cases. For instance, in Indonesia, we've talked about Indonesia. In Bali this year, they had the United Nations Alliance of Civilization meeting. And at that meeting, a number of Indonesian companies, 70 different business leaders, gathered together to discuss how business can support interfaith understanding and peace. And, you know, that's remarkable in a country, especially where, you know, there's been religious conflict, ethnic conflict. You know, people are stepping forward, and it drew enough attention that the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, came and helped launch this initiative. So, you know, looking at these examples, talking about even how faith inspires business. One example from Australia is the Sanitarium Company that makes Weet-Bix. I'm sure, you know, most of your listeners have had some. Well, it may come as a surprise to some that company is owned by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and they're motivated by their faith to promote well-being and nutrition because they believe the body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. Well, this faith motivation is part of what can operate in a free society and stimulate business ideas and give us good breakfast cereal, among other things. So, I think celebrating how faith can play a positive role and freedom plays a positive role, and sharing these positive experiences will go a lot further in today's world than just pointing out problems.
Dr. Brian Grimm, thank you so much for your time and for your insights into communities that don't celebrate the freedom that we do, and more importantly, perhaps, our role in helping them find it.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.